Well, we've said this statement many times before, and yet again, it proves true. Really, there's nothing new under the sun. I'm not against new research and new quality data being put out at all. That's exactly what we're doing here on this podcast. But sometimes you read an article and you're like, wait a minute, didn't we already know that? And why is this actually a thing? And I'm going to get into it in this episode. But here's the basic premise and the foundation of what we're talking about here. With all of this talk about birth control going over the counter, and yes, I understand it's only a progestin-only pill, it's not a combination pill, there's new discussions that are going on. And part of this new discussion is, well, if the O-pill, a progestin-only method, is already available over the counter, isn't it the logical next step to allow combination oral birth control over the counter as well? Now, that's a little trickier because, of course, it's the estrogen that may lead to some potential risks, including migraine, and of course, the biggest issue, which is the possibility of thromboembolism and a thrombotic tendency in those with susceptibilities. And that is the focus of our podcast today. You see, earlier this month, at the beginning of March 2024, a new publication came out in the Gray Journal, the American Journal of OBGYN. This is a new prospective study that is out of the UK that followed over 244,000 women. Again, this was prospective, and it also used a UK database. We'll talk about that in a minute. The title of this publication is The Risk of Venous Thromboembolism in Oral Contraceptive Users, The Role of Genetic Factors, a prospective cohort study of 240,000 women in the UK Biobank. That's the title. Again, this came out March 2024, even though it came out ahead of print at the end of 2023. It is now officially out in print. But there's some wording in there, some text that the authors put in here, and we'll give you the results in a minute, that's causing some waves yet again. And honestly, those waves aren't new at all, because this discussion of should we be doing genetic screen for thrombophilia in patients before oral contraceptives, should we be doing that or not? Because based on this publication and what the authors say, it sounds like they're saying we should kind of be screening for genetic variants of thrombophilia before we give birth control pills. Now, of course, the last thing that ACOG would want to do is put up roadblocks in making available contraceptive harder to get. And I'm not for that either. However, we do need to balance that benefit of having access to effective birth control. We do have to balance that with the possible risk that some patients in our communities may have an undiagnosed genetic propensity for thrombophilia. So what do we do here? Should we be looking for genetic variants before birth control pills? Now that, after all, genetic testing is so available. I mean, you can order that online through one of these genetic tests. If you all remember, not long ago, I had a podcast titled 23andMe and OCPs, where a patient came up to my office, had an appointment, and said, hey, I did this DNA test, and I found out that I have factor V Leiden heterozygote mutation, and I'm on the birth control pill. Should I stay on it? Now, remember, this patient had no previous history and no family history. If you haven't heard that episode, you got to go back and listen to that. That was wild. I mean, they're sitting in front of me, and I'm like, I'm sorry, what? She goes, yeah, I have factor V Leiden heterozygote mutation that my send-in swab told me I had. And they told me to talk to my OBGYN because I'm on birth control pills. Wow. Now, in that case, I was both amazed and awestruck at the availability of these tests, and also a little frustrated because now we have a problem looking for a home. Remember, no personal and no family history. Well, of course, I couldn't leave her on the pill because even though it is a low-risk thrombophilia, a heterozygote factor V Leiden, we're going to talk about that in this episode, knowing that she has that, I cannot justify her being on an estrogen-containing birth control, so we easily switched her to the implant, okay? And that's the thing, is that this is an elective issue, it's birth control, there's other options, so I'm not dying on that hill. And she was comfortable with that, and so we switched her. But it's true. Look how available these tests are if you want to know if you carry something or not. Because here's the quick clinical pearl before we even get this thing officially started. Just because a patient may be a carrier of a prothrombotic gene doesn't mean she'll ever be symptomatic, even though the relative risk is significantly higher with oral contraceptives. I'm going to give you those numbers in a minute. Yep, when you hear things like, oh my goodness, the relative risk is sevenfold higher or tenfold higher, that sounds absolutely terrifying. And it is. That's something that we need to appreciate. But what does that actually mean in terms of the relative risk compared to the absolute number? I'm going to explain that as well in this episode. And it all comes down to this. Without doubt, the biggest risk for throwing a clot is not with birth control pill use. It's with pregnancy and the postpartum interval. So we always have to put data like what we're about to cover into proper perspective. So lots to cover there. We've got lots of pretty cool stuff that we're going to touch on, including a recommendation from the American Society of Hematology, because they have a statement about whether or not we should be looking or testing for thrombophilias before birth control as well. And they had their statement came out just in November of 2023. Actually, it came out November 28th, 2023. So lots to cover, but our main piece of discussion is going to be this new publication from the Gray Journal, March 2024, on the risk of venous thromboembolism in OCP users based on a certain genetic profile. Whew, lots to cover. So let's start right now. Just trying to keep everyone up to date on evidence-based practice because medicine moves real fast. This is Clinical Pearls.
Mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Well, I'm definitely not for putting up roadblocks for women to receive effective birth control, but this thing does scare people. I mean, the idea of getting a blood clot is real, and it's amazing how a lot of that is very cultural, too. So I'm part Hispanic, everybody knows that, and in my Hispanic population and community, I mean, that's one of the perpetual myths that's out there, along with birth control pills make you fat, which they do not. But it's this fear of, oh, no, you can't do that, or you'll never be able to get pregnant again, or you're going to get super fat, or you can't take a pill because you're going to have a big clot and have a stroke. Now, does that happen? Yes, of course. Do women gain weight on the pill? Yes, of course. But is it the pill's direct fault? Probably no. Could be because the birth control pills maybe is a steroid, especially if it's a very 19-nor testosterone derivative of the progestin. It could make it a little bit more anabolic. In other words, increase appetite. I mean, who knows? There's a lot of different ideas of why that may happen, but it's not directly the result. It could be maybe an indirect result, and listen to those qualifiers. And the same thing for blood clots. We've never been able to escape the old history of the pill back when it was 100 micrograms and then even 50 micrograms, where really, I mean, blood clots were a big deal. But now with a 35 microgram pill and below, obviously that risk is much, much lower. Regarding the specific dose of estrogen and VTE risk, it seems to all be significantly lower, just under that bar of 35 micrograms. So 35 and below, you're good. The question is, as an ultra-low dose pill like 10 or 20 micrograms, is that even safer than the 30 and 35? And there are trends in data that show that, but it's not very strong data, because at some point, while the risk reduction can be shown, it may not be clinically evident because it's already very low with 30 or 35 compared to the higher formulations of 50 micrograms and above. So if somebody ever asks you, hey, is a 10 microgram estrogen containing birth control pill any safer? We're talking about ethinyl estradiol than say a 30 or 35. And the answer is maybe. I mean, it makes sense. I mean, it's less stress on the liver. It's at least in theory, less production of prothrombotic proteins. So yeah, and there is data. Again, the word is that trends in its favor, but it's just not very strong. So definitely choose the right pill for the patient. I don't like giving a 20-year-old who's non-obese, a negative family history, no other factors, a 20 microgram pill just because I want to be super safe on a VTE risk, because she's going to be hypoestrogenemic and she's going to have potentially some breakthrough bleeding. And I'd rather her stick with the pill than discontinue it because of the annoying bleeding. So I'll stick with a 30 and 35. I think that a 20 microgram pill or below is definitely a good option above the age of 35. Maybe between 30 and 35 based on some medical comorbidities, because the serum levels is a little bit lower with a 20 microgram pill or less. But the question is that a significant clinical reduction in VTE risk? And again, while the trend seems to favor that, the data is not very strong, okay? So in general, yes, why not? Lower dose is always better. That's a general rule of medicine, but regarding VTE risk with ethinyl estradiol, it looks like it would be less, but it's not extremely strong. So pick the right pill for the right patient based on a patient characteristics, patient desires, and that balance between a VTE reduction and breakthrough bleed. Remember, the lower you go on the estrogen dose on the pill, the more it functions like a progestin-only method, and the patients need to know about that possibility of breakthrough bleeding, and we don't want them to stop the pill because of an annoying side effect. Because I opened up this Pandora box of the provoked isolated event with a VTE. Let's go back to the U.S. eligibility chart, the MEC, which again is also an app. And right there under deep venous thrombosis or pulmonary embolism under that category, it says, again, if they had a DVT or PE and they finished their established anticoagulation therapy for at least 3 months, it's one of the sub-components here. If they have a lower risk of recurrent DVT or PE, combined hormonal contraceptives is a number 3. Remember, 1 is totally good. 2 is, yeah, sure. 3 is, oof, I don't know, you're kind of pushing it, kind of risky. 4 is no go, okay? And especially if you do the color-coded ones, remember, 1 is totally dark green, 2 is light green, 3 is light pink, 4 is dark red or so, right? So it's the green light, red light. So right there, lower risk of recurrent for DVT or PE because of an isolated non-recurrent episode. They still give combination birth control pills in that category a number 3. So it's not a 4. They're like, oh, you're pushing it. I do not give it. They've already shown propensity to clot. But if you want to know what the World Health Organization and the CDC's MEC says about it, the medical eligibility chart criteria, it is listed as category 3, even with a provoked non-recurring risk factor. Well, the doses of the pill is definitely not what I wanted to get into. It's the larger picture of oral contraceptive pill use and the potential of a patient carrying a genetic thrombotic risk factor, okay? Now, of course, there's modifiable things like obesity and smoking and hypertension, endothelial damage, things like that. And of course, past personal history, which for me, even if it was a non-recurring factor, like, oh, I got a blood clot in my leg with a big cast from a car accident because I was lying in bed for 6 weeks. I get that. It's somewhat considered a non-recurring incident that was a provoked VTE, the chance of having a recurrence, very, very small. I don't give birth control pills containing estrogen in that patient population, even though it was provoked with a non-recurring factor, because that clot that formed can restructure that vein. I mean, there's collaterals that form, there's endothelial damage, parts of the clot recannulize, and some may be disruptive to the vessel wall. So, and be very clear, some guidelines say that if the patient has a negative thrombophilia workup and had a provoked VTE with a non-recurring factor like an MVA and a cast and prolonged immobilization, that's not necessarily considered a traditional absolute contraindication. It's a relative contraindication. But for me, just because there's a lot of different options out there, it's not like we only have one type of contraceptive, which is combined estrogen containing birth control, I don't give it. They've already shown they have a risk for clotting, and regardless of what the thrombophilia panel shows, they could be predisposed to that, and I just don't mess with it. Having experienced one clot personally in that patient's life is enough, and I don't push him anymore. But again, some consider that to be a relative versus an absolute contraindication based on absence of thrombophilia and the fact that it was an isolated, non-recurring, provoked incident, okay? Lots of guidelines for that, especially coming out of the American Society of Hematology. Okay, now that we've said that, let's get back to this publication, again, March 2024, and let me put it in perspective. So this is in the UK, so it is not ethically diverse, because the if you take a look at the supplemental information for this, and it's very clear, it's not hidden, they're not trying to hide it from anybody, it's just you got to go to the supplemental data. It's totally white women. And there's nothing wrong with that, but it's just, you cannot likely extrapolate to a general population, because not only within the UK, which the UK is very diverse, but for this study, for some reason, it was all white women. Now, some were white Irish, some were white British, but they were all Caucasian. They were all white of some flavor, okay? So that's the first thing to note. Y'all, this reads just a little weird. I don't know these authors. I'm not saying anything. I'm not trying to get into some kind of weird political / ethnic thing at all. Let me just read you what is in the supplemental information. That's why it's important, guys. You're going to read an article. Take the time to kind of, you know, hey, guys, don't distract me. I'm reading this article. And take a look. If there's ever a link to supplemental information, take a look at that, because it's very telling. It can help put the results in perspective. So this is out of their supplemental data from what's published in the AJOG, okay? So it says, quote, participants included in our study were women who reported that they were white Irish, white British, or other white, followed by the exclusion of ethnic outliers identified by principal component analysis of the genotype data and with complete data on lifestyle. End quote. All right, we're going to get into the genotype data in a minute, because that's what they use. It's called a polygenic risk score, which is not just, hey, are you a carrier of factor 5 or the prothrombin gene mutation? It had to do with other factors as well, that it's not universally available. It has to be a blood draw. It takes a lot of other factors into account. It's kind of messy to look for any potential thrombotic gene, okay? So it's very broad, and it's not just like, hey, we screened with a thrombophilia panel. That's traditional, right? Typically factor 5, prothrombin. You can include antiphospholipid antibody syndrome, antithrombin deficiency, protein C and protein S. That's typically what we're talking about. And that included that and others. So it's called a polygenic risk score, a PRS. So it's a little different than just doing the thrombophilia panel. But back to this thing about extrapolability and applicability of this to others, here's the rest, which again just sounds a little weird, but I'm reading this directly from the supplement. Here we go. Quote, women with missing information of their oral contraceptive use, those who had no data on their covariates used, those who were not genotyped. Genotyped means, again, looking for that genetic polygenic risk panel. And then here it is. Or those who were not white European were excluded from the analysis. End quote. This is how they got the total of 244,420 women in the analysis. Ew, it just seems kind of harsh, doesn't it? Those who are not white European were excluded from the analysis. Y'all, I'm not trying to be snooty. I'm not trying to, you know, make any waves or anything, but damn. I mean, is there only white European women in the UK? No, I've been to the UK many times. It's pretty darn diverse. Okay, I get, hey, you're the authors. You choose what you want to do. So that's what I'm trying to say is, remember also that different ethnicities have different propensities and prevalences of genetic issues. So keep that in mind, right? This is predominantly white European which have different, again, percentages of factor five Leiden, both heterozygous and homozygous. That's different than Australia, Canada, and the U.S. and Latin American countries. I'm just trying to put things into perspective. I'm not trying to make waves. I'm reading it directly out of their supplemental material. Well, now that we've made everybody uncomfortable with that, let's get to what this paper showed. What a study, honestly. I mean, they actually designed this thing, like, they enrolled patients, like, from birth, and then said, let's see what happens. See what happens later on down the road. Kind of creepy, but that's what they did, okay? This is part of a big UK data bank called the Biobank. That makes me uncomfortable, but it is what it is. And that included, again, some genetic testing for a variety of thrombogenic potentials, not just the traditional factor V, prothrombin G, as we talked about, okay? And then it looked at whether they used birth control pill use, how long they used it for, and they followed these patients pretty much up until their reproductive life ended. So just to be clear, this study ended for a participant, quote, when one of the following events occurred. The VTE was diagnosed, end of study follow-up, which was based on age of recruitment, or they underwent a bilateral oophorectomy or hysterectomy, or menopause started, end quote. Again, the reason that they did this is to try to see when somebody develops a VTE based on when they start a combination oral contraceptive. Even though it was self-reporting of the pills, it didn't give you, there's no tie-in here of dose or type of formulation, all right? This is self-reported, so that's one of the limitations of this, in addition to the fact that this was all white/Caucasian European women. And then they followed them to see if they had a VTE, and then took that data and then went back to their biobank, again, makes me very uncomfortable, to see if they had this their score based on their polygenic risk assessment. So again, if you went up to your office, you as a patient, and said, I want like my polygenic risk assessment for VTE, the first thing that they would go is, huh? I mean, well, you want like a thrombophilia panel? Like, no, this is a little broader than that. So it's a little bit more complicated and not universally applicable. But that's not what I want to get into. I want to get into the results here and what they found. What they found was that the highest risk of having a VTE happened within the first 2 years of birth control pill initiation. So let's stop there for a minute. Nothing new. We've known this for 20 years that the risk isn't just continuous all throughout the birth control pill use. Some studies say it's highest at 6 months. Well, let's go back a little bit. Some say it's highest at 4 months. Some say 6 months. Some go up to a year. But by 2 years, if you're in the clear, you're pretty much in the clear. Because what happens after that is that the risk starts to go down. So it seems to be kind of like the body figuring it out. All right, this is not going away. I'm still exposed to this ethinyl estradiol and this type of progestin, and I'm good. I'm going to hang out with it. So the risk is highest, according to this study, for initiation of the pill up to 2 years. Again, that's fine. Some say it's less than that, 4 months, 6 months, 1 year. But at 2 years, most agree that that risk seems to go back down. But here's what they found. Quote, in those patients who had a high polygenic risk score, again, that's a separate algorithm, along with being a factor V Leiden and prothrombin variant carrier, had the highest risk of developing a venous thromboembolism during the first 2 years, was a hazard ratio. That's a hazard ratio of 14.8, pretty high. That's compared to just having factor V Leiden by itself, that gave a hazard ratio of 5.7, or if you had a prothrombin variant carrier, that hazard ratio was 5.23, all right? So, hey, let's just check you end up with a clot. All right, well, if you have a clot, and that's because you're factor V Leiden, that risk factor, that hazard ratio was 5. It's also a 5 with a prothrombin variant carrier. Again, these are heterozygous, but the highest risk is when there is this combined mutation, factor V and prothrombin, and this polygenic risk score. Well, of course, that's going to be the highest hazard ratio of 14. So is this mind-blowing? No. We all know that patients who have thrombophilias absolutely are at higher relative risk, they have a higher hazard ratio, but the absolute numbers are still super small. So when this patient came to me and said, I'm a heterozygote for factor V, My first words were, wow, that's amazing. How do you know that? And my second words were, well, damn. Because, you know something super helpful, but what would do with this? You have no personal history, no family history. You may never, ever, ever have a clot. Now we again have a problem looking for a home, which means I have to take you off birth control pills because now I would be a willing participant here, an accomplice, and I can't be one. And now what do we do with you postpartum? I mean, my goodness, based on ACOG, we have to have the discussion. Do you want to be on anticoagulation for about 6 weeks postpartum, even though you've had zero personal or past history? Because now we know that you're factor five heterozygous. You see that? So it raises all these other questions and issues. Now, thrombophilias, remember, are low risk and high risk. Low risk are heterozygous for factor five or heterozygous for a prothrombin G mutation. The high risk ones that have the higher propensity, the higher hazard ratio for throwing a clot are antithrombin 3 deficiency, protein C deficiency, protein S deficiency, homozygous for factor five or homozygous for prothrombin G or any combination of genes, all right? So if you're heterozygous for factor five and heterozygous for prothrombin G mutation, I mean, damn, please don't take an estrogen-containing pill. Why would you do that to yourself? So those are the classifications between high and low risk. The question is, what do we do if somebody knows this? So what became controversial with this publication is what these authors stated and what it seems that they're saying, because they don't go out right and say it, regarding screening for these issues. So here's what the authors say and don't say. You got to read between the lines, okay? But let me read it exactly as an excerpt, and then we'll go over it here real quick. Quote, because the polygenic risk score takes into account a greater proportion of the genetic contribution to the disease, using the full spectrum of genetic risk for thrombotic events may improve risk stratification and numerically identify more individuals at higher risk among oral contraceptive users than when using only factor V Leiden and prothrombin mutation carrier status. A recent study has also shown that considering the polygenic background improves the risk accuracy estimates among individuals who carry a monogenic risk variant, which may better inform decision-making and refine risk estimates during counseling. Now, here it is, guys. Here's where they dropped the bomb. For women with a high genetic risk for VTE, this means that using oral contraceptives dramatically increases their already high risk for VTE, especially in the first 2 years of use. Therefore, women in this situation need careful counseling about their contraceptive methods, end quote. Did y'all get that? Did y'all get that vibe? Did y'all get that feel? Get the flavor there? They're like, I don't know about you. I'm checking these women for genetic variants because their relative risk is much higher. Well, yes, the relative risk would be much higher, but it's a relative risk. It's not an absolute risk. Now, I'm going to show you here how even a relative risk of 7, let's say a 7, even 10, is significantly still less than the absolute risk of a VTE with pregnancy or the postpartum interval. I'm just going to give you the absolute numbers. So this is where relative risk has to be put into context of absolute number and the risk surrounding pregnancy and postpartum. So again, what do? We screen somebody and now we find something. We're like, okay, well, now we have a problem looking for a home. Now, I'm going to get into this because nobody as of right now thinks that screening for thrombophilias is needed or a good idea before birth control pill use. So that's the answer, because the title is, should we be screening for thrombophilia? Well, according to this European/UK paper, maybe using a polygenic risk score, but as of right now, CDC, WHO, the World Health Organization, ACOG, all say, yeah, let's not do that. Let me read you exactly what ACOG says about this. According to ACOG Practice Bulletin number 206, this came out February 2019. This is the bulletin that's use of hormonal contraception in women with coexisting medical conditions, okay? Because they asked this very, very question, knowing that some patients out there are going to have, be walking around with a heterozygote factor V with no personal or family history. Okay, now remember, I'm also going to get into the American Society of Hematology in just a minute. But this is ACOG's stance from 2019. And the question that they ask is very simple. Is routine screening for familial thrombophilias recommended before providing hormonal contraceptives? Guys, this is the title of our episode. This is what we're talking about. So here's the answer. Gynecological care providers should not perform routine screening for familial thrombotic disorders before initiating combined hormonal contraceptives. Screening would identify approximately 5% of U.S. OC candidates as having factor V Leiden mutation. Here it is, guys. Here's the clinical pearl. Listen to this. However, most of these women will never experience VTE even if they use combined oral contraceptives. You get that? So again, great. Now we found something. I could have left this patient on combined birth control pills. We went through this as risk, as shared decision making. I'm like, look, I don't know what to do with this. You don't have a history. Nobody in your family has a clot history. You're not obese. You're not overweight. Yes, you have a relative risk, which means it's like rolling the dice. But the absolute number of you getting something here with the pill is so small that it's a higher chance. The bigger problem is what to do with you in pregnancy, not with the pill. Now, we both decided that I could not be an active participant once we knew and she'd feel comfortable getting off because, for God's sakes, it's birth control. We've got other options, and we went with an implantable. So, and thankfully, we didn't have to butt heads there. She's like, I'm good. Yeah, I don't want to risk it, even though I know the absolute number is small. Fine. And I showed her this. I even talked to her and we pulled up this ACOG bulletin and said, right here, do you see this? Most of these women will never experience VTE. It doesn't say none of them. It says most of them will not. So this is one of the issues, okay, is yes, we can screen for it, but then what do we do? Most of these women will never have an issue. Here's what these relative risks actually look like in terms of real numbers, okay? Let's take a relative risk baseline of 1. So that general population, risk of a VTE, that's number 1, right? Relative risk of 1. That's a typical incidence. What the number actually means per year is 0.008. That's a chance of a healthy reproductive age female, just in general, having a VTE, baseline risk, relative risk of 1, 0.008. If they're a prothrombin G mutation carrier, that relative risk goes up 3. The relative risk is 3 times higher. It's like, oh my gosh, 3 times higher. Yeah, the actual number is an incidence per year of 0.02. Just take 0.008 and multiply by 3. It's 0.02. These are all published, guys. I'm not making up numbers. And now, if a patient has oral contraceptive use, the relative risk above the baseline score of 1 is 4. So oral contraceptive has, you're like, oh my gosh, it's 4 times higher. Yes, still lower than pregnancy. And the absolute number, again, 0.03. So just take 0.008 and multiply that by 4. If they are factor V Leiden heterozygous, it's a 7-fold higher risk. Like, oh my gosh, 7-fold. Yes, but that is 0.06. Y'all get this, right? So that relative risk matters. You go from 0.008, that's a relative risk of 1, background population, with factor V Leiden heterozygote to a relative risk of 7. That's an incidence of 0.06. Okay, just to be clear, that factor V Leiden mutation, that relative risk of 7 is just having the mutation by itself, okay? That's just spontaneous risk without birth control pill. If you use a birth control pill plus your heterozygous for factor V Leiden, it's a 35 relative risk increase above the baseline of 1. So birth control pill, 35 is your relative risk if you're factor V heterozygous, like our patient. That incidence per year is 0.2. So that's what these are the numbers that we talked about with my patient. I'm like, look, you have a baseline risk by yourself without having the mutation of 0.008, 35 times higher for that, which is a 0.29. Is that worth changing? And for us, it was. But you see how when you put the numbers in perspective, it's under 1%. The risk of having a VTE in pregnancy has been quoted to be as high as 0.5 to 0.9. So put that in perspective, okay? So we're talking about 0.3 with factor V heterozygous with birth control pill use compared to 0.5 to 0.9 with pregnancy. So just to put things into perspective, I'm not minimizing the risk. And again, in our patient population, I'm sorry, in my patient example, as I told you, I took her off of it because she was okay with that. I think it's safest, and I'm not going to be a willing participant to something that potentially could be harmful. But we do have to put this in perspective. The vast majority of patients with these mutations will never have a problem. So I just thought that was interesting. Thank you for being part of our podcast family. We really are grateful and thankful that you've chosen to take this journey of medical education with us. You're listening to Clinical Pearls. And just to justify to everybody that I wasn't overreacting, it is super reasonable and advised to take them off the pill if you know that they are a thrombophilia carrier. That World Health Organization even states right here, I'm looking at it in their statement, there is no universal recommendation for pre-screening for thrombophilia before oral combination birth control is initiated. However, in patients with a known thrombophilia, estrogen-containing products should not be recommended. And that's exactly ACOG's stance as well. I mean, it's not just WHO that says that. If we have a patient who has a known thrombophilia, then we shouldn't give them an estrogen-containing pill. Even though the vast majority of women will never have an issue, it's about first do no harm. So the fact of most patients with a thrombophilia will never have an issue is part of patient education. The duty to protect and primum non nocere is first do no harm, which is even though you likely never have an issue, I think it is best to not do that. And I'm supposed to encourage you away from an estrogen-containing birth control. Okay, so as ACOG states again in that practice bulletin, use of combination hormonal contraceptives is contraindicated in women who possess a known familial thrombophilia. That is U.S. medical eligibility criteria category 4. Now, that's only for the combination. Remember, progestin-only methods and levonorgestrel IUSs are acceptable alternatives for women with known thrombogenic mutations. Remember that we're reviewing this new publication from AJOG out of the UK, out of the UK's Biobank, that is trying to make the case that maybe we should be screening for a polygenic risk score before oral contraceptive use. Even though WHO, CDC, and ACOG say, hey man, look, there's no point in universally screening. You're going to have to screen for a lot of patients in order to find somebody who actually has one. So as of right now, let's not do that. Actually, to put it into perspective, ACOG gives it a number. It says, given the rarity of fatal VTE, one group of investigators concluded that screening more than 1 million combined oral contraceptive candidates for thrombophilic markers would, at best, prevent 2 oral contraceptive-associated deaths. Now, I know that sounds mean, like, are you telling me that those 2 oral contraceptive deaths don't matter? No. Of course they do. But you're sacrificing 1 million birth control candidates for those at max 2. Does that make sense? So that this is why you have to put everything into perspective, right? Now, is it, guys, medicine moves fast. Is it going to be that maybe in 2025 we're like, oh, damn, wow, we can order this thing super fast and you can do it by mail, like a Cologuard or whatever. And yeah, maybe we should be. I don't know. Maybe things will change. But as of right now, we're in March 2024, ACOG, CDC, World Health Organization, we don't want stumbling blocks to effective birth control. And according to the data, you'd have to screen 1 million candidates for OCs to find 2 at best that may have a fatal a VTE event, all right? So just put that into numbers. Now, as we get ready to wrap this up, I do want to talk about the American Society of Hematology's 2023 guidelines, because this came out November 28th, 2023, and it applies to what we're talking about here because they only gave 6 different scenarios, right? So ASH has 6 scenarios of when screening for a thrombophilia might could be done. Okay, so you don't have to, but this is their guideline. Okay, and the first one is that screening for patients for the thrombophilia, for those that are trying to use birth control pills or hormone replacement, is not necessary. Okay, you don't have to do that. And there are specific times when you should do that. And I'm going to get into that here in just a minute. So here it is, right out of their bulletin, out of their guidance. Again, the American Society of Hematology. I'm reading it right as it reads. This panel issued a strong recommendation against testing the general population before starting combined oral contraceptives. But again, they do have some times when they say, yeah, maybe you should screen for that. And it basically boils down to six different scenarios. The first are in patients with a VTE that was provoked by a non-surgical risk factor. In other words, something that was not had an MVA, I had orthopedic surgery, I was in a cast for 6 weeks, okay? That is surgical provoked. So the first of when to screen for thrombophilia is patients with VTE provoked by non-surgical risk factors, including pregnancy, postpartum, or that happen with use of oral contraceptives. So remember, it's not that you should screen before an OCP, but if they get a clot while in an OCP, consider VTE screening. The second category of when you should consider thrombophilia screening is when women have a family history of VTE and a high-risk thrombophilia is known. So if they have antithrombin deficiency, protein C, protein S, and you should then check for those in the patient, quote, in order to avoid use of hormone treatments such as birth control pills in that patient, end quote. So, hey, my mother had a VTE and they told her she had protein C deficiency. Oh, damn, I need to check you specifically for that. And if you don't have that, then it should be okay, all right? The third category are patients with VTE at unusual sites within the body if the standard of care is to not treat patients for 3 to 6 months. So this is a very unique issue. It has nothing to do with women per se. It has to do with just patients in general, but weird kind of clots that you're like, I don't know what to do with this. You can do a thrombophilia screen to see if you can stop them for using prolonged anticoagulation, right? One of the things that potentially could be in that is something like ovarian vein thrombosis, because that's an unusual site in the general population. The fourth category includes women with a history of VTE in the family who have a high-risk thrombophilia. Remember, that's antithrombin, protein C or protein S deficiency, in order to determine if postpartum or antepartum prophylaxis is necessary. So we already covered that family history of a VTE, and they're considering a hormone therapy of some type, or my mom had a PE, and they said it was protein S deficiency, and I'm thinking about getting pregnant. Again, you need to check for that, because if we would check for birth control pills, we definitely would check to see if you're a carrier of this high-risk thrombophilia for pregnancy's sake, okay? So that's the fourth. The fifth are individuals with a family history of VTE and high-risk thrombophilia in order to determine if pharmacological prophylaxis needs to be done for a transient thrombotic risk factor. Like, oh my gosh, hey, my mom had a big clot and I know I'm going in for a hysterectomy, let's say. Should I be checked for that? So you get that. So look for family history with a high risk thrombophilia. Notice all of these are for high risk for something that's considered a transient risk factor like post-surgical care. All right, y'all following this, we're going to summarize these in a minute, but I got one more, and it has to do specifically with cancer patients. This sixth category is, quote, ambulatory cancer patients with a family history of VTE who are at otherwise low or intermediate risk for VTE to guide decisions on use of pharmacological thromboprophylaxis, end quote. Again, cancer patients with a family history probably should check because they already have an elevated risk because they have cancer, and a family risk, history may be telling you something. So in short, the six categories and how it applies to us as women's health is, number one, if a patient has a VTE on a pill or during a peripartum event, they should be checked for thrombophilia. Number two, if a patient has a family history of a VTE that's a high-risk thrombophilia and you're about to start them on the pill, you should probably check to see if they have a high-risk thrombophilia in that case, all right? This is not universal, remember, this is selective screening. And in line with that, is that if the patient is going to have a pregnancy and they say that a first-degree relative or two second-degree relatives has a venous thrombotic event, thromboembolic event, and they know they have a high-risk thrombophilia, then check for that high-risk thrombophilia. This is only in those that know what they have, right? The fourth category are patients with VTE at unusual sites to see if you can stop anticoagulation or continue. The fifth is a family history of a VTE with a high-risk thrombophilia. That's the catch, guys. It has to be a high-risk thrombophilia, and they're going to go into a non-recurrent state that puts them at risk, like surgery. And then the sixth one is a cancer patient who has a family history to see if they have a high-risk thrombophilia. These have to do with high-risk thrombophilias. Now, I can't leave the podcast without telling you how everything in the world can be controversial. Okay, so let me explain this here in a minute. Remember that the one of the categories here, this is the American Society of Hematology, for heaven's sakes. These are the people who deal with blood disorders. Notice what they say. If you have a family history of a VTE and a high-risk thrombophilia is known, antithrombin, protein C or protein S deficiency, those are the high-risk ones. Or you would follow the homozygous for factor V or homozygous for prothrombin G, even though the patient would not be homozygous because that most would be heterozygous, right? Because you only get one of those copies. Then you can check for those specifically before birth control pill use. And if they don't have it, then you can start them on the pill. That's according to the American Society of Hematology. So if they don't have antithrombin deficiency, protein C or protein S, even though there's a family history, they can safely use estrogen-containing birth control. Not everybody agrees, okay? There are some opinions that a strong family history. Now, I don't mean, hey, uncle, you know, my grandpa Joe, who's 100 and has smoked for 50 years, ended up with a big PE and died at the age of 100. Man, that's just, that guy's warranty wore out. I mean, that's all. I mean, you don't have to look for thrombophilia there. Come on, man. I mean, have some reasoning. So this is why it's always part of due diligence. Before I give birth control pills, guys, I do. I ask any history of migraines. I have to ask you this. You don't have a big liver tumor, do you? I mean, I have to ask. You have really wicked migraines I need to know about. You haven't had breast cancer, have you? And they always kind of giggle. I'm like, no, look, listen, this is serious. I mean, I've got to do my due diligence. Have you ever had a big blood clot in your lungs or your legs? No. Has your mom, dad, brothers, or sisters ever had a big blood clot in their heart or in their legs? Not that I know of. Okay, I just have to ask you, okay? Now, I feel comfortable with if they know exactly the thrombophilia that the first-degree relative or two second-degree relatives had, and I check the patient for that and they don't have it, I'm okay giving them birth control pills in line with American Society of Hematology. But some don't agree with that. Some say, look, if you have a family history, a strong family history of VTE, it does not matter what the thrombophilia panel shows. They probably have some polygenic risk. You see that? That's like the European article that we just said. There's probably a combination of stuff that I can't look for. I'm just looking for the big ones. There's a lot of other thrombotic tendencies that we don't check for. So if you have a strong family history, like, oh, by the way, four members of my family have had blood clots, I'm not checking you outside of an academic exercise, because even if you're all negative, I'm still not going to give you estrogen. Now, I can check you just to see what you have for pregnancy's sake, but I'm not going to give you birth control pills because it's elective and I've got other options. Does that make sense? So I want to give you that stark contrast here that American Society of Hematology says if the patient has a family history of venous thromboembolism with a high-risk thrombophilia and you check the patient and they do not have that, then they don't have it. I mean, it's like having a BRCA-positive relative. You check the patient and they're not BRCA-positive. They're not BRCA-positive. Just go with it. And I'm okay with that. Others say, nope, it's a strong risk factor in the family. I don't know what's going on. They got bad juju. And even though I can screen for thrombophilia and they're negative, I'm not going to give it. So I'm just wanted to prepare you on that. And that's typically the case if they have an unknown thrombophilia. Like, I don't know what they got. I don't know. Or they have a combination of stuff. But if they have a monovariant of a high-risk thrombophilia and you check the patient and they don't have it, I'm okay giving it, although some would not. All right, everyone, hang with me because we're about to wrap this up. But this is exactly what we just covered. This is an editorial on contraceptive counseling with inherited thrombophilias that we found online. So it's exactly what we said. If a deficiency of antithrombin protein S or protein C has been documented in a first-degree relative with a history of a VTE, then estrogen-progestin contraception is contraindicated if the patient also carries the defect. However, it is acceptable if she does not carry the defect. On the other hand, quote, if multiple first-degree relatives have a history of VTE, particularly at a young age, less than 50, but no evidence of an inherited thrombophilia, they and the patient may have a yet unidentified prothrombotic condition that places them at increased risk of VTE. We suggest these women avoid combination estrogen-progestin contraception, end quote. There you go. How about that? This is exactly what I said. So, hey, look, you've got three family members with some kind of clot and we don't know what's going on. I'm not, why would I give you estrogen-containing birth control? Why would I pour fuel on that fire when you probably have inherited some bad juju? So that's that. Now, remember that the heterozygous factor V Leiden or heterozygous for prothrombin G is a patient specific issue. That relative risk is much less. Remember, any known thrombophilia, ACOG says, is a known contraindication, but its risk benefits there because the risk of having a big VTE event is much greater pregnant or postpartum. And so effective birth control still wins with a heterozygous factor V or prothrombin, even though ACOG says any known thrombophilia is a contraindication, like in my patient example. All right, everyone, let's start wrapping it up. Again, our main reference article for this episode was the AJOG out of March 2024, the title of which is The Risk of Venous Thromboembolism in Oral Contraceptive Users, The Role of Genetic Factors, a prospective cohort study of 240,000 women in the UK Biobank. All right, podcast family, that brings us to a wrap. As always, we're thankful for you, and we're glad you're part of our podcast community. We'll see you on another episode of Clinical Pearls.